Hello, everyone. I am Chris Papa.
And I am Lisa Flicker.
And there's Handsome Julio, the producer. And that means you're listening to the Jackson Lucas Impact Real Estate Podcast, Season 4. All the amazing people we've had an opportunity to speak with. And Jonathan Gouveia is no different. I met Jonathan at the ULI conference this past year in LA. I think you were at another meeting, Lisa. You didn't get a chance to meet him. But he is the Executive Vice President of Real Estate Development at NYCHA. So he's redeveloping all those units throughout the city. It's a huge job.
A huge job. And I feel like when people are young and they talk about wanting to go into real estate, the job he has is the job they think of, right? Like housing and New York City, and it's kind of the heart of everything. And, you know, I'm not going to say he's living the dream, but it sounds pretty good.
His book recommendation is pretty awesome. I have not read that book. And I think maybe one day he'll write a book.
I know. We're politics. We have high hopes for him.
I know. We're hitching our wagon to his, what is it? Hitching
our star to his wagon, right? Is that what it is?
There we go. Hitching our star to his wagon. Yeah. Well, so with that, please.
He said, right? That was.
What's that?
The book he recommended was The Urbanist, right?
Don't give it away. You got to listen to the end.
Sorry.
Oh, Lisa. Oh, well. Now you don't have to listen. I'm kidding. With that, enjoy the podcast. Hey, Jonathan Gouveia. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Jonathan's in New York and Lisa's in New York and I am in the Bay Area. And Jonathan, you are the Executive Vice President of Real Estate Development for New York City Housing Authority.
Yes, that is correct.
That's a pretty cool, I mean, that's a big title.
Big job. We've got a lot of apartments that need rehabilitation.
Well, yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about the New York City Housing Authority and your role there?
Sure.
Tell the world.
Sure, I'll tell the world. So we were founded in the early 1930s, currently have about 175,000 public housing units across all five boroughs of the city of New York. That encompasses about 320 developments across the city. And, you know, there was a period when we were well-funded from the federal government, the state, the city, but probably by the 1960s, that sort of capital requirement, the capital subsidy was starting to get cut back. And then that has sort of accelerated from the 1980s onward. And then, no surprise, the buildings have begun to deteriorate, right? And I think you can get away with a number of years of deterioration and it seems okay, not ideal, but you can, the buildings can function. We're now at a point where you have ongoing systemic breakdowns in these buildings, right? So these cascading compounding problems are starting to build up. And so we're at a crisis point, right? We announced in July of this year, actually, the new physical needs assessment. So we need about almost $80 billion to get our buildings into a state of good repair. So that just tells you how that growing capital backlog is starting to really impact the functionality of the buildings. So I was approached in 2018 about joining NYCHA as the head of real estate to begin a process of entering into public-private partnerships to recapitalize and rehabilitate a significant portion of our building stock. At the time, the commitment was for 62,000 units of the 175,000 units. And it's really leveraging the federal program known as the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program, or RAD. It's been used all over the country. Mm-hmm. We've branded it in New York as the Permanent Affordability Commitment Together, or PACT program.
I like that.
So we've been making great strides towards converting those 62,000 units. At this point, we actually have 37,000 units within our program. 20,000 of those have actually converted, are now under this management structure where the private partners are in doing the renovations and doing the day-to-day management. About 7,000 of those units, the renovations are complete. The balance renovations are underway. And then the remainder, so roughly 17,000 units, are in pre-development. And we expect to convert those units, you know, through 2024 and 2025. And of course, we have to continue to add to our pipeline, but making great progress towards that 62,000 unit commitment.
And how hard is it? I keep hearing all these things about the office space not being as full, the tax base not being as strong. It must be hard to get the funds to do something like that in this environment.
Well, we've been pretty fortunate, just given the timing of when the bulk of the work had been done. So, you know, 2019 through even last year, most of the projects we were able to rely primarily on, you know, the commitment from the federal government to continue to provide operating subsidies. So just to take a step back, you know, the way traditional public housing is funded is there's, you know, basically a per unit amount of operating subsidy that's granted to a public housing authority. When you convert to the project-based Section 8 model, which is what we're doing through RAD or PACT, you're entering into a multi-decade contract between the public housing authority, the PACT partner in this case, and the federal government. And so with that contract and that multi-decade commitment, you can finance against that, right? So that is how you get the capital together in order to do these renovations. So in the early part of my tenure at NYCHA from 2019 to, again, about a year ago, you know, before the impact of inflation and interest rates really sort of worked their way through the economy, we were able to do these deals. You know, they're always hard, but as it relates to the funding and financing piece, it was fairly straightforward. But certainly in the last year, it has gotten more challenging because of the cost of money itself and, of course, the cost of the commodities and everything else that has come into play. So you're right. It is getting a little more challenging in terms of getting together the money to deliver.
What are the main components of upgrading these properties? Is it the roofing? Is it like, what's the when you're like, wow, we got to hit this first. Like, what's the first thing you look at?
It is truly comprehensive. I mean, we get into every aspect of the individual buildings and the campuses themselves. And I say that because a lot of the campuses, there's these centralized heating systems and other, you know, types of systems that are spread throughout the campus, like underground steam pipes, electrical and the like. It depends on the campus, but a lot of the services are often shared on the campus. So we look at the totality of the campus, and it's really everything, right? It is a comprehensive rehabilitation. So you're looking at, again, you know, the boilers, the plumbing, the electrical, again, from a campus-wide standpoint, but also at a building level. You're also looking at the grounds, you're looking at the facades, the roofs, the windows. And then, of course, in the apartments themselves, it's a complete renovation, bathrooms, kitchens, all the plumbing behind the walls, the electrical. And unfortunately, obviously, a lot of our buildings have various environmental hazards. So your lead, asbestos, mold, has to get remediated, removed to all of the relevant standards. So it is comprehensive. Absolutely.
And how do you do it? Like, how do you go into a building and like that's occupied and say, hey, you got to hang outside for the next month? Like, what do you do?
The way we've been doing most of these have been, as you've alluded to, are tenant in place rehabs. And I think, you know, part of that goes to a longer history of mistrust between residents and NYCHA, right? There have been different promises along, and this is not unique to New York. I mean, you see this in public housing authorities across the country where promises have been made and not delivered upon. And so residents don't naturally trust the public housing authority. So one way to be able to do PACT was to say this would be tenant in place rehabs, right? So it is complicated, right? It makes the logistics, as you're alluding to, a lot more challenging. Like, how do you stage work around someone continuing to live in an apartment? And so we're fortunate. We've got a lot of teams who, separate from NYCHA, have a lot of expertise and experience doing tenant in place rehabs. So they know how to schedule the work so that it is minimal, you know, you minimize the disruption as most as possible. Again, it's a frustrating process because you're living through a renovation, not just of your apartment, but of, you know, the hallway in front of your apartment, the elevators, the common areas. So the complete renovation of a campus can take about 2 years. That's not for an individual apartment. That's the whole of the campus. So you're sort of living through this. We're trying to minimize the disruption to a person's life as much as possible. But generally what we want to do is we want to make sure that the work actually in an apartment adds up to about 2 months in total. Now, that does not necessarily mean 2 solid months. Again, they try to do is take like a whole line and do all the bathrooms, right? So line A, we do all the bathrooms in a certain period of time. then you come and then you work your way through, you know, the other lines in the building and do all the bathrooms. Then you come back and do the floors or what have you, so that you do give the residents a bit of a break. And then to the extent that residents, you know, want to be out of their apartment or need to be out of the apartment because there might be environmental hazards in the building and they need to be removed, we can temporarily relocate them either with on a campus site because we keep some vacancy on hand just in case, you know, we need them for temporary relocations. Or if that doesn't work, we can set people up within a hotel. I can tell you over at Williamsburg Houses in Brooklyn, this is a site that had significant lead. So everybody had to be temporarily relocated because there was simply no way to remove the lead in a safe manner. So everyone was rehoused within vacancies that we had at Williamsburg Houses, and they just left. And then the entire apartment was, you know, remediated of the lead and completely renovated. And then they got to move back in. So I think, you know, if residents over time are more open to the idea of temporary relocation, that might work better for them, just from a disruption standpoint.
And so when you were starting out, looks like you went to MIT and you focused on real estate and development, finance and development. Was this what you had in mind for your career?
Well, so the MIT piece was actually their professional certificate that I had done a number of years ago. But going further back, I had done...
He's Canadian. He's trying to hide that he's Canadian.
I see that. It's all about
We did our research, Jonathan. We found that you're Canadian.
It's true.
The jig is up.
So I'm from Canada, and I went to the University of Toronto. And I actually originally thought I was going to go to law school. That was my, to your question, Lisa, that I thought I would be a lawyer. And so I was always kind of interested in cities, but did not think there was a sort of career path. So I figured, what would I do before going to law school? And I came across this program called Urban and Economic Geography. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. I'll focus on cities and then I'll go to law school. As I made my way through my undergrad, I then found out about a master's in urban planning and, you know, the ability to focus on urban development and real estate. So I still thinking I'd eventually go to law school, went on and did the master's. After grad school, I went to Brookfield up in Toronto doing acquisitions and development. And I would say, still thinking of going to law school. In 2004, what sort of took greater precedence was coming to New York. I knew that I wanted to, at the time, I thought it would be 2 or 3 years in New York. It's now been 19 years.
Yes, it does. We suck you in.
That's right. So by the time I got to New York and was working then at the New York City Economic Development Corporation in real estate, by that point, I figured, okay, I'm not going to be a lawyer. I'm into real estate. I'm into, you know, a lot of work that is at the intersection of urban planning, economic development, and of course, real estate development.
So, did you see some good examples of like Toronto and Canada? Like, how do they handle, I mean, their public housing compared to New York? I mean, New York is one of the leaders, I imagine, in public housing, the most units. I feel like New York does a pretty good job with it. How does it compare to like Toronto?
One of the things, so it's a very good question, because one of the things that's interesting about Toronto that I think likely has some relevance here in New York going forward is, you know, probably about 20 years ago, they started on a program of looking at rebuilding their public housing campuses. So it would be on the basis of creating mixed income and mixed use developments, right? Unlocking the value in the large campuses that they have across the city to, one, build more complete communities, right? So you're getting more diversity in terms of income, housing ownership, uses, and the like in a neighborhood that serve residents. But then you also, with that value, you can fund the rebuilding of the public housing units. So they started, the first one, I believe, was called Regent Park, which is in the downtown part of Toronto. And that happened to coincide with a period when I was still in grad school at the University of Toronto. And so it's always been in the back of my mind as a very interesting model. So certainly, you know, I do think, you know, a number of developments here could perhaps benefit from a similar concept right? We have a ton of real estate, and we're at a point where a number of the buildings are just extraordinarily expensive to rehabilitate. You know, you're talking $500,000, $600,000 a unit to rehab. And even after that, you still don't entirely have, you know, ADA accessibility and some of the other benefits that you would expect from a building in 2023 or beyond, right?
So it's interesting. My ULI council went on a tour of Regent Park in Toronto.
She's been raving about it ever since.
It really was amazing. And, you know, I think what was amazing was how it was, you know, both affordable and market rate, but you couldn't tell the difference.
Right.
The school, I'll tell you one thing that really resonated with me, which was we were at the school at the time of pickup, right, the elementary school, and there were a lot of parents, grandparents, extended family at the school. And the person who was giving us the tour explained to us that a lot of the apartments there have 4, 5, 6 bedrooms. I think they said up to 6. And I thought that was a really interesting concept, because then you could have multi-generations living together.
Right.
Right. I don't know if that's something that could ever come to the States, but it really did strike me as an amazing way. I know that, like, without my parents and in-laws, I could not have raised my children. So having people close by is such a tremendous asset. Have they ever thought of anything like that in New York?
We do have some buildings that have a large, like apartments that have a large number of bedrooms. So I think in the very early iterations of NYCHA, they accounted for some of that. But I think over time, you know, we have to do a lot of work these days to do what we call, and what HUD requires, is called right sizing, right? So there's probably a lot of mismatch right now between, you know, people who need a 6-bedroom apartment and those who need a 6-bedroom apartment, and vice versa. I think we have some crowding in studios and 1-bedrooms when those folks should be moved into bigger apartments. So again, I think, you know, one of the benefits of the rehab work that we're doing and potentially doing new construction is that you can address these new needs, right? Because there's been a lot of demographic shift since a lot of our buildings were built. So I think there's an opportunity to do that kind of right-sizing, one, to comply with HUD regulations, but also to serve the needs of our residents.
That's amazing. So what is the day?
Lisa's kids are going off to college. She's really hoping that they move in with her. So that's really what this means.
That's exactly. I'm like, everyone come back.
Well, you don't want to live with your parents, Lisa, right? Just we're cooler parents than our parents are. Yeah. Sure. Our kids like us.
But I'm not going to tell your mother I said that.
I know. She wouldn't like that. So you were at Brookfield. Yeah. Tell us, like, can you just take us through your career briefly? And kind of like the skill sets you picked up, like, what do you need to know in order to be the executive vice president of real estate development at NYCHA? Like, what skill sets do you use on your day to day? Like, because people are listening to this who are like, they're curious about what you do and like how you do it, but also like, what do they have to learn in order to get to your position?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think part of it is skills, but I think part of it is being willing to take perhaps an unconventional path. You know, I think there's a straight, maybe not a straight line, but a through line between the different roles that I've had. I think some people are like, that's an interesting career. Like, you didn't go to Brookfield and stay there for the last 20 years and work your way up. You then came to New York, did the public sector thing, then went to Bloomberg, went back to the public sector, even did, you know, the BQX, a transportation role, and now you're doing affordable housing. So I get that, you know, on the surface, it might seem winding or windy, I guess. But I do think, you know, the through line here is, again, an interest in cities and projects that are at the intersection of urban planning, economic development, and real estate. And so, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me. And I think there are definitely learnings from all of the different roles that I've had over the years, and how it then benefits, I think, the work that I am doing here at NYCHA and what my team, you know, trying to deliver for residents. But look, I think if you're talking hard skills. Certainly, you know, going back to the very beginning at Brookfield, when I was doing acquisitions and development, primarily in suburban Toronto, this is before they sort of got into, like, there's a condo craze going on right now in Toronto over the last 10 or so years. Brookfield was not in that space at that time. It was very much single family homes out on the outskirts. But learning how to negotiate and identify opportunities was, you know, I would say one of the big skills really learned at that particular point in time. Then coming to New York and working at the Economic Development Corporation, I mean, that was an amazing opportunity at that time and during the Bloomberg administration. One, because of just the time in the city's history and the sorts of things that were happening at that time in terms of, again, economic development, real estate development, and the like. I mean, just the breadth of projects there, you know, one in particular was Willets Point. You know, back in 2008, I was part of a team of two that was charged with putting together the assemblage for Willets Point. And I will tell you, you know, everyone told me at the time, it's impossible, right? There had been many attempts going back decades, either public sector or the private sector, to buy and redevelop Willets Point. But now is my turn to try to buy those properties and put together an assemblage. And the good news is by the end of 2008, we had secured enough of the properties to actually move forward with the project. Now, obviously, due to the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, and a bunch of other things, it's long been delayed. But now, as I'm sure you know, they're moving forward with a plan, with a soccer stadium and mixed housing and the like. So it is moving forward. But the key is we were able to actually do deals in 2008, right? And I learned then, you know, the importance of really understanding your counterparty and, you know, learning what drives them. And that was the key, right? Like, spent months talking to people who were saying, no way, we're not doing a deal with you. You know, other people have tried, we'll be polite and we'll meet with you, but we're not doing a deal. What I ended up understanding was just, you know, what was happening with a lot of the business was very similar, right? They were multi-generational businesses and they were all kind of reaching an inflection point around what do they want to do with the business, right? Like, do we hand off the business to the next generation? Do we continue? And what I realized is, well, they're all looking for certainty, right? And the you know, Willets Point project could have been defeated at that time, but it wouldn't have changed the outcome for Willets Point, right? Somebody else, another administration down the road, would eventually want to assemble the property. So I said to them, listen, this will go on indefinitely, but I forget that. Like, your business, I can give you and your family certainty. We are willing to purchase your property today. We can help you relocate within New York City. You can relocate elsewhere. You can retire, whatever you want to do, but we can give you and your family that certainty. And so that started to resonate with a number of the businesses, and then it kind of went from there. But again, the key was the persistence and learning to really focus on the other side and what works for them. And I will tell you, it does a lot. It has benefited me a lot, even in my current role, because my job in a lot of ways, people will say, is impossible, right? Again, with $78 billion, it's a huge task. So how do you do that? You have to convince yourself that there is a path and you can find that path.
Right.
You're like negotiating with yourself, Jonathan. There's certainty. You can do whatever you want. There's certainty.
You got this.
Sometimes I do. Yes.
We all have to do a little bit of that. So how political is your job? Do you feel like a lot of what you get to do is kind of be a part of impacting policies? And is that kind of the next step of somebody who's in the EDC to go into something, into kind of a political role? Are we going to see you on the ballot this year? What's going on?
I hope so.
It's a good question. I mean, I don't know. You know, I think if you'd asked me 10 years ago if I wanted to get into politics, I would have said for sure. I would say at this particular point in time, I don't know that that's the case. I think it's an interesting situation we have as it relates to politics, not just in the United States, but around the world. I mean, it's just an interesting time in that world. But as it relates to the day-to-day of my job, I try not to let any of that affect what we're doing. One of the things that I tell myself, my team, and anyone who's around me is we have to focus on the residents, right? The reason we come here every day is to make sure that we can improve the lives of the residents. And so what I try to do One, because it's the right thing to do. I think you need to incorporate resident views into the work that we're doing, and have their buy-in and support. That's absolutely the right thing. But the other side benefit of that is that it sort of mitigates sort of political, you know, tug of war, essentially, right? Because we're always working in the benefit of the residents, right? So we spend a lot of time over the last several years bringing residents into our procurement process. They review proposals with us. They help select the PAC partners who are going to deliver the renovations and the like. And so I think we've earned a lot of trust with residents and with elected officials. I mean, of course, there's certainly folks who are generally skeptical of us. There's also folks who are skeptical of the public-private model, right? Some people would say that this should be entirely public. There shouldn't be a public-private partnership piece. But I think people would acknowledge that we've made great strides in making sure that we're representing the needs of the residents. And I think that's the best way to sort of mitigate against any sort of tug of war that you might get in a political context.
I love that. That's probably the best North Star you could have in this instance.
Do you find that, did you find that getting into the public sector has been, have you learned a lot more earlier on in your career by being in the public sector?
Yes, I would think so. I mean, it's funny because it's one of those situations where you don't realize it until you're a few years in, and certainly as you look back. I would say, you know, I realized I was onto something special at EDC, you know, probably year three or year four. My initial tour of duty at EDC ended up being 9.5 years. That was, again, something that I thought would be, I'm coming to New York, I'll be here for a couple of years, and then I'll move on. But I loved it. I mean, just the opportunities to learn and just the projects we were working on in that era. I happened to get, you know, a number of promotions. And so the responsibility and the job is evolving. And I was learning so much. So I realized it was a good thing at a certain point and wanted to stay till the end of the Bloomberg era just to see how it ended. But I will say again, as I look back with each passing year on that era, I would say it was foundational to a lot of the stuff that I've been able to do since. So it was a tremendous learning opportunity. And this situation that I'm in now is different than that particular era. I'm certainly learning a lot doing what I'm doing at NYCHA. But yes, I would say the public sector certainly can be incredibly rewarding and definitely creates a lot of opportunities for learning.
And you're living in the middle of the city you're responsible for, which is kind of like pretty awesome. You get to see, you know, you're not investing in Iowa or something, right? You know what I mean? Like you're literally surrounded by the stuff that you're working on, which is amazing. Can you just give us a brief overview of what you were doing with the Brooklyn Queens Connector? I find transportation fascinating. I'd love to hear some things of what New York was trying to do at the time.
Sure.
Or doing at the time.
So I guess, you know, this was announced by the de Blasio administration probably in early 2016. I was not yet back in public service at that time. But I was approached probably the summer of 2016 about returning to EDC and basically running their part of the project, which I'll describe in a minute. But the idea was, you know, you'd have EDC running a real estate analysis and really thinking about how you could create essentially a synthetic TIF, right? Sort of how we finance the 7 extension to Hudson Yards, right? It is a synthetic tax increment financing scheme, essentially. And so how would you do this for the BQX, which at the time was proposed to be a 16-mile light rail line from Astoria in Queens all the way down through downtown Brooklyn, Red Hook, and then winding its way all the way over down to Sunset Park. And so we looked at the entirety of the 16 miles and looked at, you know, quarter mile distance and a half mile distance away from the line and looked at how the addition of a light rail line would increase property values, therefore property taxes, and would that be sufficient to repay, you know, bonds and the capital costs associated with building the line in the first place. So that was the EDC work. DOT, city DOT, of course, was brought on to work on the logistics of imagining how you would design this line, how it would interact with existing you know, infrastructure, as well as other city services like sanitation and snow removal and the like. So it was, you know, those two main agencies. Then, of course, City Hall lead was sort of coordinating all the work. So we'd worked on that for a couple of years. We had concluded that the line would, in fact, pay for itself. And by 2018, it was going into the environmental review stage, which happens to be at the point at which I was approached to go to NYCHA, which was a good point for me to pass the baton, because environmental review is not my area of expertise. But anyway, it would have been, you know, I think amazing. And I think the way things had played out, obviously in 2016, 2018, 2019, we did not know it was coming in 2020. But I think, you know, with COVID and everything that's happened as it relates to work from home and how that has shifted where people work. I mean, look, Midtown and Lower Manhattan, of course, are still dominant, but there's no doubt there's been this realignment of where people are spending their time and where economic activity happens. So I hope that at some point BQX is resurrected and will serve the waterfront.
So what do you, that's all fascinating. I feel like your career has been fascinating. What do you do for fun?
Well, you know, so I know I love the city. And so a lot of the time I'm biking around the city, walking around the city, exploring different neighborhoods. And that's kind of my thing. You know, I love going to the gym and working out. But I would say, honestly, the job itself, I know some people will, no, you got to have the work-life balance. For me, the work is the fun. I'm always thinking about, you know, what can we do differently? If I'm at a restaurant, for example, and I'm sitting around, I'm looking at the decor, like the tiles on the walls or the floor and the wood and the light fixtures, and I'm thinking, and I'm often taking pictures of these things and sending it to my design and construction team, like, you thought about, like, how we can rethink about an entrance at one of our buildings, like, look at this door, look at this wall finish, right? So for me, you know, I'm always thinking, I'm always on the go as it relates to this.
And all the public housing in New York is they all look like restaurants now.
Hopefully not. We don't want a monolithic look here, but yes, I'm always looking for inspiration.
I also feel like we get the benefit of interviewing a lot of successful people like yourself. And when you find people who have the ability to be at the intersection of what really drives them and what they're passionate about, as we can hear you are, and what they're good at, I feel like that is the biggest recipe for success. So it's
right.
It doesn't surprise me that you say that part of your fun is taking pictures of what you do for work, because that excitement level transferring over is amazing.
Right.
And Jonathan, I wanted to be an attorney. Oh, I thought I wanted to be an attorney. Then I worked at a law firm and I was like, no, it took about 3 months. And I was like, no, this is nothing what I want. Well, we appreciate you dressing up. You have your nice sports jacket on, but you might want to take it off because you just sat on the hot seat.
Oh, hope you're ready.
I'm ready. Oh.
The Hot Seat is sponsored by KK Reset. KK Reset is an HR management and outsourcing consulting firm that specializes in helping organizations to reset their culture, structure, and path. They do this through services which include comprehensive consultation to identify gaps and opportunities for corporate training programs, HR services, and career mapping services. They've collaborated with nonprofits, startups, and academic organizations to protect them from liabilities, reduce turnover, and preserve their brand. They have also collaborated with a number of my clients on the real estate front who are not large enough to have their own in-house HR program. So they outsource it to KK Reset. KK Reset comes in, maybe sits on site a couple days a week and provides, you know, everything you need from an HR perspective for your firm. So it's a great resource for those shops who just maybe it doesn't make sense for them to have in-house HR function. So please check them out at kkreset.com, kkreset.com.
Excellent. Do you have a book and or podcast recommendation for us? We get a lot of interesting ones here, so.
Sure.
And a lot of not interesting ones too. No pressure.
Hopefully this one's interesting. It's actually a fairly new book. I think it came out about a month ago. It's The Urbanist, Dan Doctoroff and the Rise of New York.
Oh, cool.
So that was just published, like I said, maybe about a month ago. I have not gotten all the way through it, but it is again, for people who are fascinated, A, with New York, and B, all at the intersection of all of these different disciplines that we've been talking about today, I think it is a fantastic book that really tells the story, obviously, of Dan Doctoroff and his contribution to New York City, but it also tells you a lot of what was going on and how we got a lot of the amazing projects done over, you know, during his tenure and even after his tenure. And what's interesting is embedded within the book and the story is you understand about his leadership style and how that has continued on, right? Even after he stopped being the deputy mayor and moved on and did different things. Like his leadership style, right, has been sort of infused in a lot of us and carries on to this day and helps drive a lot of the work and advancements that you see in the city. So I think it's a fantastic book. Continuing, I have not completed it yet. It's very thick and long and it's very enjoyable. So there's a lot to get through, but I would recommend it.
I love it. My whole family's New York family. So the more I learn about the city, it's a fascinating city. What is your most, you spoke about Willis Point and some other deals. Like, what is your most memorable deal? Doesn't have to be a big one.
You know, maybe I shouldn't have given that answer before, but I would say Willis Point. I mean, look, I'm fortunate because of the work that I've done in the city. So, you know, there was an old parking garage in Long Island City, which is now known as Gotham Center. And it's amazing to see that. You know, even the projects that I do today, walking around, I mentioned Williamsburg houses, you know, going to these different NYCHA developments. It's just amazing to see the transformation. Back in the day, I worked on Kaufman Astoria Studios and their expansion.
Oh, yeah. I worked with them.
Oh, cool.
Too.
There's this great breadth of projects across the city that it's just amazing to be able to see and be reminded of as I, you know, walk around the city and the like. But I would say, again, the one that was most transformational, I think, from both a professional standpoint, but also a personal standpoint, was Willits Point.
That's awesome.
You guessed it. So I assume you've done a tremendous amount of hiring in your time. Is there anything in particular that you look for or any interesting questions that you ask when you're interviewing folks?
Sure. It's a couple of things. One, I like to understand the story. Where are you coming from? Where do you think you're going? And how does this role, and in this case, NYCHA, how does it fit into where you're, like that whole arc? You know, I one of the things that I'm very much focused on as a general matter, like in any role that I've had when I've hired, I like to, you know, build teams that surpass expectations. So whether it was, again, working on Willits Point or the BQX or anything, I almost now get a bit of a thrill when people say it's impossible, because then I like to put together the team that can actually defy the odds. So, you know, again, I think in the case of what I'm doing right now at NYCHA, the odds are, you know, stacked against us. So how do we put together a team that is going to outperform and exceed expectations? So I think it's important to assemble a group of people who are going to really be very clear about, in this case, why they're coming to work in the real estate group. Why is it that they're interested in NYCHA? You know, do they have the, it can be a frustrating job, obviously, as you might imagine, both internally and externally. So do you have the, you know, the either stubbornness or fortitude, however you want to view it, to put up with those frustrations and power through every day? So I really like to understand the story of why. The other piece is, I'd like to think of the real estate group at NYCHA as, frankly, a little startup, right, within this big, massive agency. And we've cultivated a little startup sort of mindset and culture within the group. And so I look for people, frankly, with an entrepreneurial mindset, which I know might seem a little absurd because we are absolutely not, you know, we're not a business at all. But I think bringing in those types of mindsets around, you know, perseverance, you know, problem solving, having a sense of ownership of the work, right? All of those characteristics I am looking for. And I think part of it comes out in the story, right? The why are you coming, or why are you interested? And I think, you know, obviously I like to test people and have them give me specific examples of when they can demonstrate these different characteristics. And to the extent that they can, I think we have, you know, we've end up picking some pretty good people. And I think we've been fortunate. You know, one of the things that's interesting is when I started, it was a very small group. There might have been about 15 people. But the funny thing is, I had a ton of vacancies in the department. There was something like an allocated headcount of almost 40 with a ton of vacancies. And that's just a reflection of, you know, there had been some turmoil over the last few years, and a lot of people had cycled through my role. And so roles were not backfilled. So I was somewhat lucky because I was able to go on this hiring binge. Headcount that I was already given, it just wasn't being utilized. So we were able to put together a pretty amazing team. And this is why, you know, in 2023, we've got 37,000 units like churning through the PAC program, which I don't think anyone expected would have been possible in 2019. But again, it's bringing together a group of people, you know, who are so focused on the goal.
It's awesome. And this is the Impact Real Estate Podcast. Do you have any mentors that have had a great impact on you that you'd like to give a shout out to?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of mentors who did not know they were mentors. I don't know that I've formally like ever had like a formal conversation where we identified each other as mentor and mentee. But you know,
I'm Lisa's formal mentor, formal mentor.
Yeah. But you know, I would say, you know, when I think back again to the EDC, Bloomberg, you know, one person who I worked a lot with, who certainly trained me, pushed me, and perhaps did not know was a mentor, would have been Seth Pinsky, who was the CEO of EDC at that time. And certainly learned a lot of valuable lessons from him that served me well during my time at EDC and certainly continue to this day.
Yeah, I know Seth. He's a great guy. Well, Jonathan, it's 12/20/2023. Holiday season. Please have a Merry Christmas. A Happy New Year. Look forward to that. We met in person at ULI this past year. It was great to meet you in person finally. And thanks for coming on the podcast.
Good to meet you. And thanks to both of you for having me. This was fun.